It's quite technical in places, isn't it? Some of it, I suppose, would be the kind of thing that if you were studying a butcher's course or something like that, and you were going down that, that would be the sort of thing you'd probably read as a textbook. You know, you really, when you're, you know, trying to work out what's going on here, those kind of drawings you get of animals where they're all kind of quartered up and the different parts are all given their names, that's a sort of diagram that's useful, isn't it, really? And, you know, people do get the impression sometimes when they're reading through the book of Leviticus, they've entered into the sort of the twilight zone. It's quite hard to know the difference, what's going on, the difference between these different offerings, the guilt offering, the sin offering, the fellowship offering, and it can become a little bit confused. And it is technical because it is a manual, really, effectively, for these priests, and they have to use it. It's a technical manual for the priests. And of necessity, there are repetitions, because there are some things that, whether you kill an animal for this reason or you kill an animal for that reason, you still have to kill the animal, and so there's repetitions. There are things that are being stated again and again, and bits of language come up again and again and again. I certainly know that I find sometimes that, you know, I've just got a new mobile phone, and you get a little manual with it. They're trying to make it very simple for people these days. They try and put it all in big letters so that they know that various people can just follow through the instructions. But I still look at these things, and it just my kind of glaze over and ask Isaac whether he'd be so kind as to help me set my phone up. You know, you need an expert, don't you, to help you sometimes. And I know that there are theological geeks who will kind of go through a passage like this, and they will spend a great deal of time trying to discern the difference between the different kinds of offerings and so on. And there's value in that, I don't doubt for a minute. But I also think, given that my own limitations and our limitations and the limitations of time and the rest of it, it's probably helpful just to seize on some principles here, seize on something that is going to be of direct application to our lives. So that's basically what I'm about. And I think, as you were reading through it, my hunch is that, like me, as a reader of Scripture, the same thing would have struck you as struck me as I was reading through it, the same Spirit being in us. And that is perhaps going on verse 7. If you have a look at it in verse 7, when it says the same law applies to both the sin offering and the guilt offering, there is something that's been stated there that these things have in common. There's a common factor there. And the common factor there, and I think this which comes out so clearly and really is the, one of the great purposes of the way this little bit is written, is that the sacrifices belong to the priests. That's the kind of the headline, right? And you actually, as you read through it again and again, that's the point that's being made. When this kind of sacrifice or this kind of offering, the portions belong to the priest, the hide belongs to the priest, the grain belongs to the priest, this part, the thigh, is the priest, the breast portion, that's the priest's. So it's been very, very clear what belongs to you. You who are reading the manual, you who are going to have to do the work and get out there and do the work, what's in it for you, if you like? What's your portion? What's your reward? What's your part? And I think this is the real function of chapter 7 there, is it delineates what belongs to the priest very, very clearly. All good. But there are conditions. There are conditions. So the Lord is granting these people, the Levites, certain responsibilities, certain privileges, certain benefits, certain reward. But there are conditions attached to those things. Look in verse 18, for example. We've looked at it, and you perhaps saw before one of the offerings there. After three days, the thing that's been sacrificed, that's been given to you to enjoy, if you don't make use of it within a certain time frame, it's no longer acceptable for you to enjoy. In other words, it's almost like the fridge, when you open the fridge and you've got a sell-by date. There's a certain sell-by, if you like, nature to these privileges. You're given something, but you must enjoy it, and enjoy it within a certain period of time. You can't just look at it and say, well, I can use it when I want to. There are conditions attached to it. A certain promptness, a certain response has to be made to what God is giving these people. And they have to do it within a certain time frame. And then, verses 19 and 20 sets up some other conditions as well. So if they don't make use of their privileges within a certain period of time, they're going to lose them. That's the first point that's come over there. But there's also other conditions in verses 19 and 20. And it's to do with their own, that the fact is that these sacrifices, these privileges can be defiled. You can spoil them. You can ruin them. They're not bomb-proof. That if you don't look after what God gives you and look after it within the time frame that you've had it given to you, and you don't treat it with the proper care and the proper respect, there is a possibility here that you will lose it. It will become defiled. It will be spoiled. You know, I suppose if there's a piece of meat, I know this in certain families, it depends what family you live in. You have the 3-second rule or the 10-second rule. Depends what it is, right? A piece of food drops to the floor. A piece of toast drops to the floor. People say 3-second rule. As long as it has been on the floor 3 seconds, you can still put it back on the table. That doesn't happen in our house. But do you take the point? You can defile something, can't you? It becomes defiled. As soon as that's hit the floor, if these sacrifices, if the priest drops the meat in the dirt, drops it in the dirt, you can't just pick it up and wash it and present it to the Lord. You can't just now enjoy it. It's ruined. It's spoiled. Just like if you don't act promptly and use it quickly, it will be ruined and spoiled. You won't be able to enjoy it. So too, you can treat or mistreat these things in such a way that they're ruined and spoiled to you. You won't be able to enjoy them. And the defilement that can come to these privileges that they're being granted could come by accident, like dropping something, like we described, or in verse 20. It may be because you yourself are the one that contaminates it. You come to the sacrifice with dirty hands. You come having touched something that you shouldn't have touched or been involved in something you shouldn't have been involved with. And then you try and enjoy the sacrifices. You will defile those sacrifices. They will become unclean. They will be ruined. You will spoil them. And you won't be able to enjoy what God is giving you. So there's two sets of conditions, right? There's two sets of conditions already. But there's another condition, and that's found in verse 22. Now this is quite hard, I think, culturally speaking, I suspect, for us to understand. So I'm going to have to ask you to be a little trusting in what I'm about to say. Because in verse 22, we're told that there are certain portions of the sacrifice that you must never eat, that you must never touch. They're not yours, they're not for you, and they never will be. The fat and the blood. The fat and the blood. Verse 22, right thereabouts. Now, we are in a culture where ever increasingly fat is being described as a social evil, right? Fat is something you're being warned all the time to avoid for health reasons. Fat is bad. Fat is negative. Fat is bad for you. It's toxic, etc., etc., etc. So when we see that they're not allowed to eat the fat, a lot of modern people come to the conclusion that isn't God good how he looks after his people and even perceives their health needs and cares for them? But that's not what it means. In the context of this time, fat is the most precious aspect of the sacrifice. The fat of the land. It's the best part. We looked at that before when we looked at some of the sacrifices earlier on, didn't we? It's the best part. Now, I think most of us are willing to accept that that's where it's very flavorsome and so nutritious and so on and so forth. And in a culture like theirs, to eat the fat was what you would give to your most honored guest, to your most honored guest, as a way of showing favor. The bit that we are going to find harder to digest, literally, if you excuse the pun, is the fact that you and I, the idea of eating or drinking blood is quite anathema to you. right? Our culture has invested in us a social repugnance and taboo about eating and drinking blood. And that's partly because the New Testament forbids us, and Christian cultures consequently are forbidden, and so there is a big thing about eating blood. But I tell you, if you went to some of the animistic cultures in Africa, the cultures there, things are very, very different. If you're a little bit squeamish here, just put your fingers in your ears for just 1 minute. But one of the prize things that you would do at a festival or at a feast, if you wanted to honor somebody, is you would take your precious cow or precious cattle, and you'd bend its neck to one side like this so its veins were exposed, and you'd insert a pipe into its neck, into its jugular vein, and out through the vein would come a spurt of blood. And you'd catch that in a bowl, and you'd mix it with milk that you'd taken from the same creature. And those two things together would be mixed together in a warm, glutinous meal considered to be the most luxurious and nutritious meal available. And eating blood and drinking blood is considered to be, in many, many cultures, the absolute pinnacle of the sort of from the sacrifice. Warm, nutritious, easy to digest, instantaneously beneficial. And I want to put it to you that when it's talking about not eating the fat and not eating the blood here, it is not talking about disgusting negative bits that are not to be eaten because they're bad for you or there's something wrong with them, although you may feel that way, right? These are the best parts of them all, right? And those parts are never, ever, ever for you as the priests. They belong to the Lord. Right? It's about praise. It's about honoring one who is greater than you. Giving the best to the one who is best. Verse 33, however, tells us what portion belongs to the priests. So that's not for you. So that's one of the conditions. You've got to eat in good time. You've got to keep it clean and look after it. There are certain parts that you've got to give to the Lord because he is better than you. But what's good news? In verse 33, you see the thigh portion there, which is for the priests, very much so, and is waved before the Lord as a sacrifice, as an offering to show thanks and praise and to show their portion in the earth. And does anybody know which part of beef you get the sirloin from? Does anybody like sirloin steak in here? Anybody got a soft spot for sirloin? I know there's one or two vegetarians. I'll look the other way. Anybody like sirloin? I like sirloin steak, right? Sirloin steak is from the thigh, right? It's the top of the thigh. It is the tenderest. Would you agree? Do you like sirloin steak, Chris? Colin, yes? Partial? From the waiter. Okay. Well, the waiter gets it from somewhere, now you know where. It's the top of the thigh, the tender top of the thigh, right? It's the best portion, the choice portion of meat. So even though they're not allowed to eat the best, the very, very best, what they are given is good. God does give them good, good gifts. Good gifts to look after, good gifts to treasure, good gifts to treat well. Good gifts to eat and enjoy promptly and not waste and despise or reject. So let's sum this up. What we're saying is that this portion is talking to the priest, telling them there's no room for sloppy, slothful, mindless action and behavior here in the Lord's house. You have got privileges to enjoy. Make sure you don't miss out on the good things that God has got for you. They need to be diligent. They need to be prompt. They need to be thankful for the gifts of God. Okay, let's move it forward. We're New Testament people. People say to us, what's this to do with me? This is a long time ago, the Levitical priests. I'm going to make a quote here, just to read a quotation written in 1520. This is modern by comparison to Leviticus, okay? I'm at least going in the right direction, all right? 1520, Martin Luther. He wrote this. He said, that the Pope or Bishop anoints, makes tonsures, ordains, consecrates, or dresses differently from the laity, from the ordinary people, may make a hypocrite, or an idolatrous oil-painted icon. But in no way does it make a Christian or make a spiritual human being. In fact, we are all consecrated priests through our baptism. As Peter says, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, you are a royal priesthood. You're a priestly kingdom. And then in Revelation chapter 5, verse 10, through your blood, speaking of Christ, you have made us into priests and kings. There are privileges for you in Christ. Privileges for you in Christ. So I suppose I'm drawing this analogy from the Old Testament priesthood to the present priesthood of which you are a part. You are part of a new and better priesthood. Don't you think the privileges and the things you have to enjoy are new and better? Don't you think the responsibilities you also have are consummate with the gifts that you're being given? Now, when I'm talking about New Testament priesthood, I am not talking about ministers. You know that. I am not talking about ministers. I'm talking about you. I'm talking about you if you believe. That's what I'm talking about. Ministers, 1 Corinthians 4, verse 1, Martin Luther pointed people to that, which says, no one should regard us as anything else than just ministers of Christ, servants of Christ, dispensers of the mysteries of God. We're no different to anybody else. We just have a job to do. We're not priests. If anything, maybe we're elders with a duty to raise you up, to feed you, and to encourage you in your walk with God. In the end, it doesn't matter whether you're an elder or a deacon or a member or a congregant. If you're a believer, you're a priest. You're a priest. So what's your priesthood? What do you have to do as a priest? What's your duty? What's your calling as a priest? 1 Peter 2, 9 is what Martin Luther refers to there. And in that verse it says that your priesthood is to show God's goodness. Yeah, that's what you're called to do. You've got to show God's goodness. But, going back to the lesson that we're picking out from chapter 7 of Leviticus, I hope you can see, showing God's goodness, because some of you might wince a little bit. If you are going to show his goodness, surely what you're being told here in relation to what you see there in Leviticus chapter, you are also being called to enjoy God's goodness. To have it. To possess the sacrifice for yourself, to possess Christ for yourself, to enjoy Christ for yourself, to know him, to have a good part in him, to be fed on him, to feast in him, to make him your feast. And out of the strength that the gifts of God press down into you, from that show his goodness. Out of the strength that he blesses you with, from that make that your praise and your strength and your song. And you know what I'm going to say next? That there are responsibilities. There are responsibilities. If the priests in the temple had responsibilities to keep the sacrifice clean, if they had responsibilities to act promptly, if they had responsibilities to not forget that there is one over them that is greater than them all, then how much more do we also have that same responsibilities to keep him clean, to keep ourselves clean for him, to acknowledge him as greater than ourselves in every part, to never transgress and turn, cross over the line and presume ourselves what belongs to him alone, and not to be slow in our responses and his gracious invitations to us to come near to him and to enjoy him for ourselves. So, We're called to show God's goodness. And we are given to enjoy his goodness. And we're called to do all these things in a way that honors his goodness too. Does it distress you sometimes when either yourself or somebody else speaks of Christ in such a way as demeans him, shows a lack of appreciation for who he is and what he's like, casual comments, casual theories people throw out, Dan Brown's book, his conspiracy. Do these things, I think one of the greatest answers you can give to somebody when they are taking the Lord's name in vain, as it were, when they're sort of speaking of Christ as a curse. I don't know what success you've had in trying to challenge people or talk to people about this, but I've found that one of the most effective ways is, you know, you are talking about the person that I care about more than anybody else in the whole wide world. And when you speak of him like that, you distress me greatly. You disturb me greatly. Imagine if I was speaking about the person you love most in the whole wide world the way you're speaking about my Jesus. And then tell me whether we're friends. Just tell me then where we would stand. Because I want to be your friend. And I want to know you better. But not at any price. I'm not saying it always yields results, but it always yields a result. You always get a result. And you have to defend the gospel. He is precious. He is really, really precious. He's our portion. What have we got in the world? Who have you got in heaven but him? Who else is going to speak for you? Who's going to save you? Who's going to rescue you in your hour of need? Who's going to speak to God on your behalf? Who's going to intercede? Should we not then intercede and speak for him? Should we not stand up and declare his praise? We've got to appreciate the sacrifice. Value the sacrifice. There's not enough just to do that in a strident sort of way, is it? And just be out there strident, arguing with everybody and taking the world on like a rugby player, you know, the hacker at the beginning. Come on, you know. You can only do this if you're speaking genuinely out of your own honest enjoyment of him, your own valuing and appreciation of him. If he really is tender, the more tender and precious he is to you, the more ferociously you will defend him. The more courageously you will speak out for him. The more valiant you're going to be as a soldier of the cross. But that won't happen if he's not genuinely in your heart as King and Lord. Because we're called to enjoy him first, aren't we? Lastly, this is not my last point, this is my last sentence. There's this thing of time and opportunity as well, isn't there? Time and opportunity. You know, there are people that just think that they can take all the time in the world. Do it tomorrow. Maybe the day after. Days go by. God is not mocked. God is not mocked. There is a limit. There is a limit. I mean, the whole point isn't... I mean, unless I'm totally mistaken, and I've been challenged on this before, and maybe I've got it wrong, and if I'm wrong, please tell me if you think I've got this wrong. But I think the whole point about patience, the whole point about patience, is that it eventually comes to an end. It is a limited commodity. It's exceedingly precious if you can find it. And if you can get hold of it, or you can extend it, you can extend it so far. And we are called to be patient and to extend grace as long as we can. But the whole point about patience is it can't go on forever. It has an end to it. And whether it's in our evangelism or when we're dealing with ourselves and our own reluctance and
unwillingness to change, as if tomorrow will do. And I'm conscious of this in my own heart, so I'm not judging anybody. It won't do. It won't do. We have to act promptly. We have to enjoy him today, while today is today. And that's where we will hear his freshest and will be most pleasant to us, and our experience of him will be at its very, very best. Let's walk closely with the Lord. That's what I'm trying to say. Walk closely with the Lord. Should we sing Amazing Grace? Because what better song can you think of to extol what we have in him? He's given us so much. Amazing Grace. It is a sweet sound. It's so pleasant, isn't it? To enjoy Christ and to enjoy the gospel and to enjoy his goodness.